This podcast of Studio 360 is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 85,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/Studio360.
Today in Studio 360, the leader of one of rock's coolest acts, the Flaming Lips, remembers a life-changing event. Wayne Coyne used to work at a fast food restaurant in Oklahoma City.
I was robbed at gunpoint, laid on the floor with a gun to our heads.
Nobody was shot, but for Wayne, nothing would ever be the same.
It occurred to me for the first time that I was actually alive.
And later in the show, we asked the artist Miranda July to predict the future, which is also the name of her new movie.
I don't know what your dilemma is, so I would like you to send it to me now, psychically.
Plus, a respectable novelist brings sexy back.
If I'm going to write a sex book, what I would want as a reader is to really have it all the time.
A new novel by Nicholson Baker is the dirtiest book I've ever read. This is Kurt Anderson, and that is all ahead today in Studio 360, right after this. I'm bringing sexy back.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Support for Studio 360 is provided by Live from Lincoln Center, broadcasting the Mostly Mozart Festival opening night with conductor Louis Langres, violinist Christian Tetzlaff, violist Antoine Thomastiet, and soprano Susanna Phillips on Tuesday, August 2nd at 8. Broadcast times are available through local PBS listings.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. On today's show, the filmmaker, actress, writer, artist Miranda July adds fortune teller to her resume, and she'll talk with some of you who wanted to know your future. And later, Nicholson Baker's newest novel is called House of Holes. It's about sex and pretty much nothing but sex. But first, The Flaming Lips seem likely to be just another 90s one-hit wonder. An alternative rock band from Oklahoma, they toured for a decade before finally hitting it big in 1993 with their song, She Don't Use Jelly.
But she don't use butter, and she don't use cheese, she don't use jelly.
It was an ironic grunge anthem, one that landed them a cameo on Beverly Hills 90210.
Hey, is that the Flaming Lips?
Well, it's not Michael Bolton.
That's for sure.
You guys seen Donna?
No, she's recovering from her wounds.
But the Flaming Lips didn't go all Hollywood or fade away. Instead, they ditched their guitars and started experimenting with tape loops and synthesizers. In 1999, the band released their ninth album called The Soft Bulletin. And right now on tour, the band is performing that entire album live. Wayne Coyne is the longtime mastermind of the Flaming Lips, and he says The Soft Bulletin was made partly in reaction to the departure of the group's other dominant member, a virtuoso guitarist.
It was. Well, when he left, me and Steven, the other writer in the group with me, we almost decided, let's just not worry about guitars for a while. And we went in this other way. But we also thought it would isolate this small audience that we had and make them think, well, you guys, you know, now you suck. And so maybe we
the
realized
indie curse.
This. Well, right, that this, you know, if you're going to turn your back on us, yeah, go ahead and make your boring, you know, symphonic music or yeah, whatever. But I would also say part of us was working in the idea that this could be our last record that we make.
Well, it's always good, isn't it, in any creative endeavor to make each one as though it could be the last, yeah?
I don't think people realize the power of that because, you know, you really are doing it and you can say, you know, I don't care what people think because we're doing this as our own statement. But if you're like us, that lasts for about 5 seconds and then yeah, you go, oh my God, what's going to happen?
Well, and then you made another record. Then I think your next record, which was Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots, came out and people liked it. Critics liked it. It sold pretty well, and I want to play a little bit of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's Do You Realize? And I'm told that album, Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots, is in development to become a Broadway musical to increase your Renaissance man accomplishments even more.
Now that you say it, you're right. But and again, you know, you playing that particular track, and these are hokey things to say. We've been given this great little gift that people love. I mean, people just love this song. But we did not consider it as being anything other than just another song. And it's this epic, beautiful statement. And every night we play it, it's the last song we play at the end of the night. And people cry and people are just overwhelmed sometimes with a happiness and a satisfaction and a joy.
And that song that came out of what? What was the inspiration for writing such a thing?
You know, I have to say, for me, sometimes I'm literally sitting there in front of a microphone with my I still use a four-track cassette recorder from the early 90s. And I'll just, you just simply strum a couple of chords and you'll sing something. And you go, oh, that was kind of cool. And I remember singing the line. There's a line that says, do you realize happiness makes you cry? And do you realize that everyone you know someday will die? And it seemed to me, something that I observed as you get older or that you have these experiences. That everyone you know someday will die. And when I played that part of the demo for Steven, like I said, the other co-writer in the group, he was like, oh, that's just a perfect Wayne-ism. No one else but you would sing that in a song and make it seem so right and so genuine and so innocent. And I was like, oh, okay. And it becomes this signature line that is sort of sums up this existential joy that the Flaming Lips, I think now, in some, you know, to some people represent. I think there's a mystery as to how do you know the things you know? And I say, I don't really know, but I'll sing you a song.
Well, and that song, Do You Realize, is in fact the official state rock song of Oklahoma. And you're not just a guy who grew up there and now lives in Brentwood. You're still an Oklahoman and have been.
Well, yeah. And again, you know, none of that ever occurred to us to be that big of a deal. This music came from Oklahoma. How bizarre, you know, as if it came from outer space or something.
Right.
And I think, you know, I've said it before, it's kind of like Santa Claus coming from the North Pole or the Beatles coming from Liverpool. When you can come from a place,
right,
and it evokes something. I mean, that's right, really how innocent we were. It never occurred to us that we should move to a Los Angeles or a New York or something.
Well, similarly, I've read that you worked as a cook at Long John Silver's for years after you started the band, right? I mean, you would go out and tour and then go back and fry fish sticks?
Well, I don't want you to paint this that as we are so successful as a band that I would sacrifice my time as an artist to go back there and cook. I mean, we didn't make very much money. We would tour around like a lot of groups did back then. You would just simply go out and play.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes you'd make money. Sometimes you wouldn't. And I was lucky that, I mean, I started working, I'm not sure everybody knows what a Long John Silver's is. It's a fried fish place,
yes,
you know. But it is wonderful, and I still eat it once a year. We sort of restrict ourselves. But yeah, I started to work there when I was 16. And I have to say, I really loved it. But that's easy for me to say because now I'm in a successful.
You're not doing it now.
Yeah. But I some of those things that happened to you there, and I would say that I was robbed at gunpoint, laid on the floor with a gun to our heads because we were robbed late one night, thinking that here I was going to be just a statistic that you read in the paper the next day, that I was, you know, that we were killed during a robbery at this fast food restaurant. And those things, the robbers, eventually they left without killing us, obviously. But we laid on the floor for a little while in just this silence and going, they're going to come back.
Right.
But we all sort of got up together. It was myself and there were three other gals. And we all sort of looked at each other. And to me, it occurred to me for the first time that I was actually alive. I'd never thought in my whole life that I'm alive,
Yeah.
I mean, I can't say how profound it was.
And then it freed you to become a rock star. your newest album, which is Embryonic, came out a couple years ago, seems like Flaming Lips 3.0, that you're going beyond the old symphonic sweep. And I hear a little more pessimism in some of the lyrics than we've been used to. Like, I want to play a little bit of See the Leaves about...
Excellent, yeah.
...where we're going environmentally. See the leaves, they're dying again. See the light, it's fine again. See the grass, it's dying again. See the sun, it's trying again. That is Flaming Lips' See the Leaves, which is exactly the kind of song that at 22 or 24 I would have played loud and again and again and again. And there you are making it you're almost as old as I am. Did you feel like you were swerving in terms of the sensibility you wanted to portray on that record?
Well, even though, some of these previous songs, The Race for the Prize and the Do You Realize, even though we knew that we created those and those, took a certain mindset or whatever, we never really left any of that other stuff behind. And especially in that song, See the Leaves, I think we're hinting at this thing that is nature. It is the greatest thing. It's the only thing, but it's also the most powerful and horrible thing that we have. I saw a nature type on some cable channel, and a group of hungry lions attacked a water buffalo, and they were actually eating his back legs, and this water buffalo was still alive. And this idea that somehow, nature just takes care of you. It's not. And so I thought, that's not the only truth there. And sometimes I'd say, the things we said back then, I was wrong. We say this. I mean, you're allowed to just say the truth as it occurs to you at that time. I think that's what art is.
Well, and speaking of saying the truth as it occurs to you, you seem like such an incredibly pleasant, nice guy. and yet, over the last couple of years, I've seen you make all kinds of trouble for yourself by slagging bands you've played with, like Arcade Fire and Beck. And is that just because you're a guy who doesn't edit yourself and just tells the truth?
Well, again, I'd say it's the truth as it happened to me, but, I mean, the Arcade Fire has a billion great things said about them every day.
Right.
Everybody thinks they're the greatest thing in the world, and I actually like some of their music quite a bit. And I bet I'm the only person that said anything other than they're the greatest thing ever. I don't really remember what I said. I'm sure it was something like, I think they're a bunch of p***s or whatever. I don't really know.
Pretty much.
Yeah, And in my experience, they were. I mean, I won't explain the whole story because it's long, but we were at a festival, and the Arcade Fire walked in. Everybody had to clear out of their dressing rooms. They locked off the stage. Everything was treated as if the Arcade Fire are now Guns N' Roses, and you're not allowed in here because they're rock stars, and you're just insignificant.
How un-Canadian of them, too.
Well, I thought so, and I really didn't really even care about it anymore. To me, it had become sort of exaggerated and funny. And so I would say maybe they've changed, and none of that is true now that was perhaps true then. And I would just leave it at that. And if I saw them again today, I could say, let's try again and see where we are now.
Yeah. So who else do you think is a jerk? We can start a new feud today.
I think we lose too much by being too cautious. The risk of saying something that we can't take back, so what? Who cares? I mean, this is music. It's art.
It's rock and roll.
We're supposed to have opinions. We're supposed to be weirdos. Yeah.
Wayne Coyne, it's been a complete pleasure, and I'm going to thank you very much.
Yeah, and like I said, I love your show. So thank you for having me on.
Wayne Coyne is the leader of the Flaming Lips, and you can catch them on tour this summer. And if you haven't had quite enough Flaming Lips, we've got more of my conversation with Wayne at our website. That's studio360.org. Six years ago, the indie film Me and You and Everyone We Know took me and pretty much everyone else by surprise. It was a smart, funny, first-time feature by the short story writer and performance artist Miranda July. Her second movie, in which she also stars, opens this weekend. It's called The Future. A confused couple in their mid-30s are trying to figure out what they should do with their so far slackery lives. They decide to adopt a stray cat, and their perspective on life changes. Seriously changes. Did I mention that the cat can talk?
We'll come back for you, Papa. Papa. That's what they called me.
For the movie, Miranda July created a website that predicts people's future and tells their fortunes. We asked if she'd do the same thing for some of our listeners and then posed this question for you. What is the essential dilemma of your life right now? Hundreds of you submitted an answer to that question. And now, for a very fortunate few, we are putting Miranda July's psychic advice skills to the test. Miranda, welcome to Studio 360.
I'm so glad to be here.
So we'll get started. And our first lucky listener whose existential future is now in your hands is Eric from Baltimore. You are on the air with Miranda July.
Hi, Miranda.
Hi, Eric. So how we're going to do this, I don't actually know what your essential dilemma is. And I would like you to send it to me now psychically. I see something floppy. Does it involve something that's floppy?
It has the potential to be floppy.
Do you want to now in a sentence just tell me the dilemma?
Yeah, my wife is a sensitive sleeper, and she has announced to me that she would like to downsize from our queen-size bed to two smaller single beds.
I myself insisted that we get an enormous king-size bed because I wanted more room and to be undisturbed.
And maybe the king-size is the way to go.
Yeah, it's not even that much more expensive, maybe.
I'll have to look into it.
Great.
Thanks a lot, Miranda.
Very good. The floppy. I mean, you know, we're talking about people lying on a mattress. That's pretty good, you charlatan.
Oh, you're right. You're right. Wow. I have no idea how I'm supposed to do this.
I think you're doing it for real. And I think this is like a seventh career for you now. And you're on now, Molly, in Milwaukee with Miranda July, who will foresee your future and solve your most pressing existential crisis.
Hi, Miranda.
Hi, Molly. I don't know what your dilemma is. I haven't been briefed on this. So I would like you to send it to me now psychically. Okay. What I saw was your face in the wind, and the wind was blowing it really hard, and you were kind of like tears were streaming down your face, and it was both exhilarating and scary. And that is leading me to believe that there is some boldness that you either are in the midst of or you need to do, but that it feels crazy. Tell me, is that the essential dilemma?
I feel like that is a pretty accurate description of how I feel about my dilemma. I've had this goal that I've been working towards pretty substantially for the last 10 years, and I've recently achieved it, and now it doesn't really look as appealing.
What was the goal that you were working toward for 10 years and reached?
I just earned my PhD.
Well, you know, I think this might be just a time where you have to do a little bit of enduring until you get to the next place. because you don't exactly know what to do now, and the desire is to act. And if you could do with me now, I'll do it with you, a low moan of endurance. So this is just the lowest moan that you can muster, and I'll do it with you here on the count of three. Okay, one, two, three. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Now for our next caller, Jen in Toronto. Jen, welcome to Studio 360, and here is Miranda July.
Hi, Miranda.
Hi, Jen. I'm going to just guess that there's a certain no small amount of anger involved in this. Am I right about that?
There's a little bit of anger some days, sure.
Why don't you just tell me your problem?
Well, now that I'm a new mom, that's the sounds in the background, is it inevitable that I'll start making mom art?
Hmm. I feel like I was really right on with the anger, because I'm angry for you, and I'm also angry for myself. I mean, I want to be a young mom. Well, I'm never going to be that young of a mom at this point. I just made a movie, and I was worrying about that in this movie, that I couldn't write about my fears surrounding having kids, because that just was so embarrassing. And then I thought, like, screw that. Let's make mom art, like, really, really cool. That's, like, the most important thing. That's, like, the president or, you know, God or something. So mom art would just be, like, the biggest, most important genre of art that there is. Of course, you will be belittled, and that's how you know that there's not space there, and that's how you know it's worth your trouble. To speak to the anger aspect of it, let's just, because I'm obviously a little angry too, let's just do a maybe like a punch a pillow type thing here. I'm just going to pound the desk here. Here, I got to move my water.
I have my steering wheel. How about that?
Oh, great. Yeah. Let's just.
Should I honk?
Are you driving, Jen?
With the child?
Yes, but I have a Bluetooth.
Oh, good.
I'm terrified, but go ahead.
Okay, we're just going to do it for one sec. We're just going to get out a little anger now. You can get the rest out off the air.
Okay.
One, two, three. Okay.
Yeah.
How was that for the engineers?
Oh, the baby's crying now.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Gosh, see, this is how we know that I'm not a mom yet. Oh, terrible idea. Okay, we're going to leave you with that.
Thank you. Okay. I feel a sense of release, and I'm going to start the mom movement.
Okay, great. I'll join you there soon.
Awesome. Thanks, Miranda.
Bye.
Bye.
Good, you know, good radio, Miranda, making the baby cry. You know, babies were harmed in the taping of this piece.
I think it'll be good for the baby in the long run.
Yes, yes. The filmmaker, artist, and now fortune teller, Miranda July. Her new movie is called The Future, and we will continue our conversation about that and other things in just a minute. Later in the show, Nicholson Baker's new novel has us scrambling to hit the bleep button. You're listening to Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Don't go away.
This podcast of Studio 360 is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 85,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For our listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One audiobook to consider is The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris by David McCullough. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/studio360. That's audiblepodcast.com/studio360. Support for Studio 360 is provided by Live from Lincoln Center, broadcasting the Mostly Mozart Festival opening night with conductor Louis Langres, violinist Christian Tetzlaff, violist Antoine Thomas-Steet, and soprano Susanna Phillips on Tuesday, August 2nd at 8. Broadcast times are available through local PBS listings.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 with the artist and filmmaker Miranda July. Her new movie, The Future, opens this weekend. So before the break, we heard you foretell the future and provide some life advice to three different listeners. How much stock do you actually put in your or anyone else's supernatural empathic powers?
Sure. I mean, you know, I grew up in Berkeley.
Okay.
And more specifically in a household that was really full of belief in a kind of open-ended way,
uh-huh.
like didn't rule things out,
right.
Because not out of any fanatical feeling, more just
right.
like life was more interesting if you kind of heard things out. And so in a way, a very freewheeling wrong answer
yep.
might be as helpful as like advice from a therapist, because sometimes you just need to be like knocked out of your
right.
your hole you've been burrowing.
You have done a lot of work in your artistic career that is interactive and crowdsourced. And the piece you did, Learning to Love You More, had thousands of people on your website, strangers writing essays for you. You like this as a mode, right? I mean, dealing, sort of opening up your world to strangers' input.
Yeah. Like, I mean, just doing this now with each person, I was like, wow, this is a whole real life,
yep.
you know, just as real as mine, especially if you're, you know, a maker of fictions and your own kind of mythology. And it's really liberating and kind of terrifying. The challenge for me is to not just instantly fictionalize all these people.
Yes, yes.
And make them like, you know, characters in a story in my head.
Speaking of your fictions, your newest one that is about to appear in movie theaters around America is a movie called The Future, which on the one hand is this very somber and hyper-realistic story of this couple in their mid-30s trying to figure out what they should do with their lives, but also has these pronounced magical realist touches of a cat who talks, a moon that talks. How did this movie germinate? What did it begin with?
It began actually with a performance. I just finished my first movie and I was leery of attempting to do a second one. So a lot of those elements you just mentioned, like the talking cat, began in this much more free form world of performance, which is a great realm for me for that reason.
Right. Because it's just looser and people aren't investing millions of dollars in it?
Yeah, that partly. That's huge. And also because people are walking in really not having any sense of what to expect as far as form. I mean,
uh-huh.
there could be no words and that wouldn't even be that weird,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah. The character you play in The Future, Sophie, at one point in the film says, "I wish I was just one notch prettier," which made me laugh out loud because you're pretty. But do you feel as though you wish you were one notch prettier?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Even though you said, "But you're pretty," like I'm not, you know, like that's not the main thing about me is how pretty I am. And that's something I have in common with most people. You
that's
know?
True. So. That's one thing you have in common with most people.
So we're all in this together. In fact, I've sort of discovered even the very pretty people, like after screening, sometimes like a gorgeous sort of modelly woman will come up to me and say like, "That line, oh, that's like so me." And I'm thinking like, oh, shoot, if you're
yeah.
just one notch prettier, then I need to be like nine notches prettier
yeah.
if you don't do it. And, you know, I guess if you're going to be a woman and put yourself in your movie that you wrote, it seemed sort of nice to, in an offhand way, kind of speak to that. Like,
yeah.
you know, I'm not doing this because I think this is like such an incredible treat to look at me. Like, this is kind of like I'm working furiously to make my case here.
The couple in this movie, one wonders if having a child or not is something that has been discussed a lot. You mentioned earlier when you were talking to one of the people whose minds you were allegedly reading, you mentioned a prospective child a couple of times. Are you planning to have a child soon? It sounded like maybe.
Well, on the air, I'd like to say. No, I mean, I won't get into the specifics of that, but certainly, you know, when I started this movie, I was in my early 30s, and then I was in my mid-30s, and everyone around me started having kids. And now those kids are, like, old enough to, like, talk to me about the movie.
Uh-huh.
And so it is a decade where the sense of time is really heightened. And, you know, because my character is so strange and artistic and whatever, it seemed important to put that in there. Like, it's not just motherly women who are thinking about this. It's like all women. It doesn't matter how artistic you are. It's part of the conversation that you're having in these years. Part of me thought, like, wow, if I don't get this movie made soon, I actually might have to stop. Of course, that didn't happen. It got made, and I still have time. So the rest is private.
Are you working now in your ever flipping, toggling from medium to medium? Are you working on something else, working on a movie? What are you doing now?
I just finished a book, a nonfiction book called It Chooses You that will be out in the fall. And that also involves the public. It's kind of a side project I did when I was writing the movie. I started interviewing people selling things through the classifieds.
Uh-huh.
Some really weird things ended up happening, which are in the book.
Great. The Future, directed by and starring Miranda July, opens this weekend. You can read all the submissions that our listeners made for our collaboration with Miranda at studio360.org. Thank you so much. It was really a pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks.
Back in 1981, when Nintendo released Donkey Kong, it was pretty much the first arcade game where you did more than just blast Space Invaders, as wonderful as blasting Space Invaders was. It contained an entire world with a damsel in distress and an unlikely hero, this little Italian plumber named Mario. 4 years later, Mario got his own game and the honorific Super, and the rest is history. Nintendo just announced that it's releasing Super Mario Bros. For its new handheld console, the Nintendo 3DS. Maybe no adult on Earth is more excited about this than Tom Chatfield, who writes about video games. His love affair with Super Mario Bros. Goes back decades.
When you look at Mario, you're looking at a cultural icon that surveys consistently show is more recognizable to people than even Mickey Mouse. And while it seems very strange that a fictional plumber in video games should be the world's most recognizable semi-human being, in a sense it also adds up. Mario himself has appeared in over 200 games now, and you're talking about sales of more than 250 million units and counting. He's been in the most successful games of all time. And this is pretty remarkable because they are also the most critically acclaimed games of all time. So it's a bit like you've got Orson Welles and Steven Spielberg and George Lucas wrapped up into the figure of Mario's creator, Shigeru Miyamoto. Was born in 1952 and who didn't study game design, who studied industrial arts and crafts. And he joined Nintendo as his very first job, and he's been there ever since. And he just decided to build something that other people hadn't thought to build within video games. Something that told a story, something that was about a man exploring a world. I'm just going to start playing through a level here. You may hear in the background, I'm playing an underground level, and I've got a famous underground theme going on here. This is me jumping, and I'm just about to pick up a mushroom there. And this mushroom allows me to smash blocks and generally be a much more powerful character. And I'm just going to jump over a few things and pick up a whole bunch of coins here. There's some coins there. Now, if I pick up enough coins, if I get 100 coins, I get myself an extra life. And down here, you controlled a human character who, across a number of different screens, had to jump and leap and climb around a kind of building site in order to save his girlfriend from a wild beast, a large monkey, a bit like King Kong, that had kidnapped her. This was very, very radical. This was a new way of thinking about games as miniature worlds that you could go into as a person and explore and enjoy controlling human actions in rather than just shooting or manipulating like it was a machine. So I'm going to try and take myself into a slightly different level here. This is a miniature castle. This is one level which is slightly spookier than the normal ones. You might hear the music is a bit more kind of organ and scary. One of the joys of the video game series is the way that it's taken influences and archetypes from all over the world, really, from everywhere, in order to try and come up with things that move people powerfully. So on the one hand, you've got a sort of monkey that's a bit like King Kong coming in. On the other hand, you've got architecture in a game that's influenced by everyone from M.C. Escher to Lord Rogers. The game's creator has talked about being inspired by Japanese legends about ghosts and about magical food transforming people, but at the same time about his own childhood when he loved exploring caves and wandering through woodland and going for walks. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to get fired out of this pipe and then try and drop down and reach a hidden door. Excellent. Now what's going to... It's an interesting question as to how Mario will live on after his creator is gone, as I presume will inevitably happen. But there is perhaps a real question as to whether he can continue to reinvent himself, as to whether the games will have this strange radicalism they've had when every few years, pretty much, Miyamoto appears to have sat down and thought of a way of remaking the old with new technology. Oh! And I dropped off the bottom of the screen, getting a bit too big for my hand boots there.
Tom Chatfield is the author of the book Fun Incorporated, Why Gaming Will Dominate the 21st Century. Mark Anderson produced our story. Coming up, the novelist Nicholson Baker has written a strange new sex novel that gives the painting The Garden of Earthly Delights a run for its money.
If Hieronymus Bosch could do it all those centuries ago with no kind of... Why can't we just open up our brains and let it go?
That's in a minute. This is Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Don't go away. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Nicholson Baker is a major American literary figure. He's written nonfiction books about World War II, poetry, the fate of newspapers. But as a novelist, Baker has another side. Back in the 90s, he published two racy R-rated works of fiction. Now he's returning in a big way to the raunch with his new novel, House of Holes. This is definitely not just R, I'd say NC-17 for sure. The most relentlessly, explicitly sexual novel I've ever read. And maybe the dirtiest ever by a serious author. Heads up, we'll keep this conversation clean, clean-ish anyhow, but make no mistake, this is strictly for adults. House of Holes is a series of fantastical sex scenes that all take place in a kind of theme park called the House of Holes. Baker says that his main inspiration for the book wasn't porn, but a famous Renaissance painting.
What I was really thinking of was Hieronymus Bosch's Garden of Earthly Delights, where everybody is, you know, they're contorted, they're strange, a lot of eggs. And it's so hot and startling and so kind of entirely out of a man's imagination.
Yeah.
And you feel that, you know, just look, if Hieronymus Bosch could do it all those centuries ago with no kind of, why can't we just kind of open up our brains and let it go, you know? And that's what I tried to do, is just to say, where do I want to go today, you know?
Yeah.
There is a cartoonish quality to
yes.
this because
yes.
The House of Holes is a place where impermissible things happen and you are sucked into the House of Holes almost without your control because
right.
you're sort of chosen. you're chosen because you're good looking or you're, I don't know, funny or something, but you're sucked down a straw or you're, you know, you climb into a dryer and yes, the back.
Circular portals that you didn't know were portals until you were sucked into them.
Yes. And once you're there, then you meet this woman named Lila who kind of figures out what you should do. And she's and she's got enormous breasts.
As much as I often enjoyed this book, I couldn't keep track of the characters, so they didn't. I didn't feel as though I was following a hero, and I'm not sure I made out a plot. Was that an effort to reflect the nature of plotless, characterless porn?
Well, you know, the plot of a sex scene is actually very straightforward, and there are lots of plots. It's just that they're plotlets. The plot is.
Right.
Boy meets girl or girl meets boy and they flirt a little bit and they take off some clothes and maybe something happens and it's, you know, and they're in the grown room or they climb up on a mountain and they, you know, do some wild things while watching some zebras. Whatever it is, it's always going in a certain direction. Originally, I tried to write the book with fewer characters. But honestly, when you are reading a sex book, you want a lot of people. You don't want the same person taking his or her clothes off over and over again. I found that is a terrible mistake if you're in the literary pornography business.
Although almost entirely heterosexual people.
Well, you know, that's a point. I mean, you know, I ask a lot of myself. I want to push the envelope or whatever you want to say. But I have to do – when I'm writing a sex scene, it has to be something that in some way excites me. You know, that if it's about a woman, I want to think, whoa, that's an interesting thing to be thinking about her thinking about that. So – and I'm a heterosexual guy and I can't help it. So
– Really? So you're comfortable imagining a woman's point of view but not a gay person – not gay person's point of view.
Yeah, because a woman – well, look, if you imagine a woman's point of view – if you're a guy, you're a heterosexual guy, what you think of is it exciting that I get to think about what she's thinking about? That is, in fact, the most exciting privilege for a novelist is to dream that up.
Did you do anything beyond doing what a fiction writer does in imagining to get into women's heads and trying to figure out their sexual fantasies?
Well, you know, my wife is long-suffering about this, but I always want to know what she thinks about things. And I do ask her a lot of questions, and she says, look, that's for private. She doesn't want to be put into a novel. She's already been put into two novels in various forms. But did I do research? Of course. I mean, I read up on things. I looked on the internet.
what is your – other than having her specific notes, what did your wife think of this book?
She thought it was funny, and she liked it. And I was hugely relieved because there are some nervous-making scenes. I mean, she was a little bit troubled by the voluntary head detachment where the guy, Ned, you know, he's good-looking. His body's good-looking, but his face doesn't have the puffy-looked look that women like, says Lila. And so to pay his debts, he has to undergo a voluntary head detachment. And then there's a scene in which this body, Ned body, has a kind of strange bodily sex with this woman who just wants a kind of brainless time, you know.
Right.
And she was troubled by that. But then I rewrote it a little bit. And I think this book maybe actually I'm hoping that this book appeals more to maybe to women readers than male readers.
So could you read from that slightly rewritten wife-approved chapter for us? And before you do, I want to remind listeners that this is fiction intended for adults.
Okay, this one is called Ned Undergoes a Voluntary Head Detachment. Ned, the golfer, had incurred terrible debts at the House of Holes, and he was called into the main office. "Let's see your body, please," said Lila. Ned removed his shirt and pants. "Very nice," she said. "And the underpants, please." He stepped out of them with a smile, his jig swaying. She looked at him for a long time, tapping a pen on the arm of her chair. "Your body is adorable," she said. "My face is not so good, though," he said. "Is that what you mean?" "It's a perfectly nice face," she said. "You mean well, you're a nice man, but you don't have that smoldering, puffy-lipped look that a lot of women like." I know. So what on earth do I do? He said. I would say that for you, with that body, the fastest way for you to pay off your debts is with the voluntary head detachment. What's that? He said. I'd like to try it. Think about it carefully, said Lila. Your head will be removed and put on a wheeled pedestal. Kathy will roll you around and change your plasma bags and be sure that your electricals are all shipshape. And my body? He said. Your body will go into one of the six headless rooms. Okay, and what happens in there? Your body and a woman will get to know each other. How? My body won't have a head, he said. No, it won't. There are women who don't want you to have a head. Oh, I see, okay, he said. And your body will have a simple form of consciousness. How? We put a cap on the top of your spinal cord and redirect your nervous system. Your body will be able to think in a very limited way with your spine, penis, and balls. Your ass will serve as a neuronal proxy as well. I see, he said. Makes sense. Well, let's do it.
That's Nicholson Baker reading from his new novel, House of Holes, describing a head removal procedure that I'm sure many women especially might regard as already in effect, the way that men operate perhaps in sexual encounters.
Yes, yes. The voluntary head removal has already happened.
Exactly. In the New York Times a couple of years ago, probably while you were in the middle of writing this book or starting this book, the writer Katie Royfe wrote this long essay that got a lot of attention about how big name, middle-aged male novelists of the present day had sort of abdicated writing about sex, unlike the Mailers and Roths and Updikes of the previous generation. In any way, were you consciously reacting to that idea? Like, oh, not enough sex? I'll show you.
Well, I wish I could say I didn't know that the piece was out. I mean, I felt that I had really felt that I had done my thing with that. But then when I delivered the manuscript and somebody showed me that Katie Royfe thing, I thought, oh, well, thank goodness. And I do think, I mean, I don't know. I think every novelist has the option of having as little or as much sex and everything else, cars and love and airplane flights or whatever it is that you want to put in your book, that's what you
sure
want to do. So I feel there's plenty of sex in book. But when I write a sex book, I really like it to be wall to wall. I mean, that's my problem. Is when I write a book that's about libraries or about the beginnings of World War II, obviously
right,
there's
right
not going to be. I like a lot of different things in life. But if I'm going to write a sex book, I feel I want, what I would want as a reader is to really have it all the time.
But what sexy literature, other than, I presume, John Updike at his sexiest, do you enjoy reading? Henry Miller? What are your, who are your favorites?
I haven't read Henry Miller. I'm saving that.
Really dirty, by the way. I read it for the first time recently. Just incredibly dirty. Not as dirty as this book, but really dirty.
Oh, you're so nice to say it's not as dirty as this book.
I'm sure in 1940, you know, we have to adjust. It was dirtier. But
adjusted for inflation.
Exactly. Objectively speaking, it's not as dirty as this book.
I went to Planet Fitness a lot while I was writing this book, and I listened to Fanny Hill on audio. And I thought that was an absolutely brilliant,
the 18th
crazy
century Henry Fielding novel. Fanny Hill, yes?
It's a Henry Fielding wannabe, or maybe even better than Henry Fielding, I think. Lots of really affectionate, funny descriptions. And they're dirty, but they're arousing. They're kind of tender. But anyway, I listened to it while I was doing the machines, and I learned a lot from it. So there was that. I also listened to some women's romance novels. There's one called Dirty, I think, by Megan Hart. And I'd be on these machines and listening to these kind of breathy women narrators reading these dirty sex scenes. And it was great, actually. It was fun. And I thought, well, this is the business I want to be in somehow. But I can't write dirty women's romance novels, but I can do something. I can get close to it. I can try to be, you know, be in the parade.
You can write postmodern simulacra of dirty women's sex novels, I guess.
Yes, and that's what I was trying to do.
Actually, I think more shocking to me than any of the extremely nonstop dirty language on the 270 pages of this book was the dirty language in the press release from your publisher, from a major publisher, Simon & Schuster, all four-letter and other dirty words. That I found weirdly more shocking than anything in the book. And I'm wondering, they obviously are embracing it and going whole hog. How did they react when you turned it in?
I was honestly, I agree with you. I was very shocked. I don't know. Simon & Schuster is a big name publisher. I don't know what they're doing using dirty words in their promotional material. I find it very, but you know, that's what's exciting.
Yeah.
And you can get something to happen in the world that is a little bit forbidden. We need the walls and the barriers so that we can high jump or pivot or Fosbury flop ourselves over them.
Yeah. Nick Baker, thank you very much. This was a pleasure.
Oh, Kurt, thank you. It was a joy to talk to you.
Nicholson Baker's new novel, House of Holes, A Book of Raunch, is out in early August. I'm bringing sexy back. Special, what's behind your back? Yeah. So turn around and I'll pick up the slack. Last week on the show, I argued with the conservative culture critic John Silber, who railed against the architects Frank Gehry and Daniel Libeskind for their flashy buildings, which John Silber calls absurd.
Old Dolly Parton had it right. It takes lots of money to look this cheap.
We asked you if there's a building where you live that you consider absurd. Barbara from Seattle nominated the Experience Music Project, Frank Gehry's monument to Jimi Hendrix and rock and roll. Barbara writes, "It looks like a giant creature run amok in a used car lot and then swept up all the damaged cars and left them in a pile." But Patricia from Texas took issue with the very premise of our question. "This is an insulting witch hunt," she told us. "How about talking about what makes good architecture, the mother of all the arts? It's not necessarily about profit. Long live Gehry and Libeskind." So what do you think? Let us know at studio360.org. We are still collecting photos of buildings you think are crazy, in a bad way. And thanks to everybody who's already written in. That's it for this week's edition. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next week. Studio 360 is produced by PRI and WNYC. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Michael Guerriero,
Alana Harper,
Sean Twigg,
Rachel Greenberg,
Liz Viella.
Our theme music is by David Van Tegum. Special thanks this week to Michael Raphael and, as ever, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. And I also want to give a special shout-out to the truly excellent Mike Guerriero. We will miss you.
PRI Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360's American Icons.
Ricky, can I be in the show?
The show that invented TV as we know it. I Love Lucy.
This stuff is in the DNA and in the brain of every comedy writer.
Lucy was always about desire. She wanted to do what she wanted to do. That's a seditious act.
I Love Lucy and the Birth of American TV. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.